So today is an auction sermon, and Nancy bought it. Don't remember how much she paid, but I hope it'll be worth it. And she has a preamble to the sermon to offer.
When I saw Reverend Joy's auction offer, I knew immediately what I wanted. I wanted help in dealing with my feelings about climate change. I had just gotten back from New Zealand, where I saw muck, where glaciers used to be, and my feelings about that were still pretty raw. I'm normally a pretty even-keeled kind of person, but climate change was, and still is, really upsetting me. It's so big, threatening the whole Earth in so many ways. And worse, as I kept thinking about it, I would move into even more depressing thoughts about the ultimate end of the solar system when our sun dies. Where do you go from that? I mean, it doesn't get much worse than that. Those thoughts just led to despair as well as anger and fear. And I really spiraled down, and I thought a sermon might help. So I bought one. And afterwards, I continued to think about my feelings and gradually comforted myself with the thought that it is highly probable that there are many other living beings in the universe made of the same stardust as we are. Living beings on those planets would be our very, very distant cousins. So even when our great mother Earth and our great father Sun are dead pieces of rock, those planets and our cousins will, may go on. I still feel angry and fearful and sad about climate change here on our Earth, but I feel comforted when I think life that I have reason to care about will go on, no matter what happens here. Finding that right thought to think provided the comfort I needed. I needed to think that right thought. Now, whether that approach works for anybody else, I don't know. But it helped me to think and act more effectively, to think more clearly about climate change and maybe be able to do something about it instead of despair. But once I found some comfort, I still wondered about the more general process of finding comfort. How does it work? What does it mean to find comfort? How can we provide comfort to others? Often we do it with good thoughts, well-placed thoughts, but we fail through clumsiness. So that's what I asked Reverend Joy to talk about. And now it's her turn.
And that really is an intriguing subject. So thank you for forcing me to wrestle with this one. Nancy, before I tackle what you came around to deciding would be the topic, the general process of finding comfort for oneself and offering comfort to others, I want to say something about the big ugly monster that you were confronted with that caused you to purchase this sermon in the first place, climate change, and your depressed and helpless feelings about it. I know that you're not alone in these feelings. We Unitarian Universalists are generally very aware of how we are tampering with the planet, and we can't and don't pretend that it's not a serious problem. Therefore, a lot of us get depressed about it at times. I know I certainly do. The modern problem of climate change is big and overwhelming. Although, as I mentioned in a sermon a few weeks ago, recent international accords give me some sense of hope and give me the comfort of knowing that it is possible to slow or even stop the process of overheating the Earth. When Nancy told me about her thought process, leading finally to the reassuring feeling that even if we mess things up here on planet Earth, life will go on elsewhere in the universe, when she told me about that, I strongly empathized with her. I myself come around to this thought whenever I contemplate the end of planet Earth. The fact is, as she mentioned, even if we humans don't mess things up on planet Earth, mess them up beyond repair, the sun and the Earth do have a shelf life. Life on our planet is eventually, ultimately, doomed. In a billion years or so, the sun will begin to swell. The Earth's crust will begin to heat toward 1,000 degrees and more. The oceans will dry up and start drying up long before that. And Earth will become uninhabitable. Assuming humans are still around, our only hope of surviving this catastrophe is transplanetary travel, or, as some have speculated, some form of technology or evolution that somehow liberates us from our fragile bodies. But as Nancy says, if there is life on other planets, and many astronomers think that it is probable, the belief that life goes on elsewhere may offer some comfort. It does for me, and always has. We each have developed coping mechanisms for when times are hard in our own lives, or when we feel the weight of natural and human-wrought disasters like climate change. I would like to offer some of what I have learned to use to comfort myself through dark times. And I will use some poetry for illustration. For me, poetry itself can be a healing balm. When I am agitated or upset by some event in my personal life that I can't control, I sometimes use what I call my 10,000-year rule. I soothe myself by remembering that in 10,000 years, none of these personal concerns will matter one bit. Now, I realize this is a bit quirky. To tell the truth, it may not matter in 10 years, let alone 10,000. But I tend to take the very long view. I find with events that I can't control but that have that potential to cause me to obsess and dwell on my upset, like maybe having said something stupid that I can't unsay, I find that a long view of how unimportant this really is in the scheme of things helps me to put it in perspective. This process actually sounds like Nancy's technique for self-comfort, finding the right thought to think. It is a very cerebral path to self-comfort, and in some situations, it works quite well. But that approach doesn't work for tragedies like, for instance, the loss of a good friend. 18 years ago, I lost my best friend to cancer. Back then, I took another path to comforting myself. Rather than denying the pain or distracting myself all the time so I wouldn't think about it, or finding a comforting thought, I just set aside time each day to let the feelings wash over me, to really feel what I was feeling, to let that sadness weigh me down for a time. I found that gradually the weight got lighter and lighter, which you could say would have happened anyway with the passage of time. But I think being very intentional about my grieving helped me to heal. And it gave me time to acknowledge and to honor what that dear friend meant to me. Another path to self-comfort for me is bringing into awareness my gratitude. Gratitude for the sheer gift of being. Gratitude that there even is a universe for us to dwell in, despite the fact that pain and loss are built into this universe. It also gives us many opportunities for joy, for delight, and for wonder. In illustration, I'd like to offer this poem by Denise Levertov, Sands of the Well. Days pass when I forget the mystery. Problems insoluble and problems offering their own ignored solutions jostle for my attention. They crowd its antechamber along with a host of diversions, my courtiers wearing their colored clothes, caps and bells. And then, once more, the mystery is present to me. The throng's clamor recedes. The mystery that there is anything, anything at all, let alone cosmos, joy, memory, everything, rather than void. And that, O Lord, Creator, Hallowed One, you, hour by hour, sustain it. Levertov uses theological language, thanking the Creator for sustaining the universe. But one can also be grateful for existence without addressing a Creator. But something sustains this amazing and improbable universe. Or maybe it is self-sustaining, but it is nevertheless deserving of our profound gratitude. As physicist Stephen Hawking pondered, what is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? Hawking says that science constructs a mathematical model to describe the universe, but that science can't answer the basic question of why there is a universe for the model to describe. Why does the universe go to all the bother of existing? He wonders. A good question. Maybe one that can't be definitively answered. But the universe is here. We are here, nestled in the great womb of stars. And that, to me, is a miracle. Gratitude for this gift of existence itself, is comforting for me. Another road to my own self-comfort is to remember and try to access the core of strength inside me that I believe most of us have inside of us, that strength that has the power to hold and sustain us when the road is bumpy. I believe this core of strength thickens with each passing year and with each incident of loss, each incident of hurt or sadness. It gets stronger not because we avoid pain, but because we face and we travel through it. When we are young, each tragedy, each mishap even, at first seems insurmountable. But as we get older, many of us come to trust that whatever hardship, pain, or anxiety befall us, life is still worthwhile, and we will get through the dark tunnel to embrace life with joy again on the other side. Here is a poem by Ellen Bass that speaks to this process of returning to awareness of what a gift life is, even after or even in the midst of pain and disappointment. The thing is to love life, to love it even when you have no stomach for it, and everything you've held dear crumbles like burnt paper in your hands, your throat filled with the silt of it. When grief sits with you, its tropical heat thickening the air, heavy as water, more fit for gills than lungs. When grief waits you like your own flesh, only more of it, an obesity of grief. You think, how can a body withstand this? Then you hold life like a face between your palms, a plain face, no charming smile, no violet eyes, and you say, yes, yes, I will take you, I will love you again. Some of my methods for coping with life's pain and loss are ones that I know many of us use, allowing myself to be distracted for a while, doing things that I enjoy or that are renewing and healing, listening to music, taking a walk, sitting in silence, taking in a movie or play. Distraction can be healing as long as it is not used all the time to deny or avoid feeling or facing the difficulty. Another coping tactic is seeking out support from other people, friends, colleagues, support groups of people in the same situation. Each one of us must travel our own road, face our own pain, and find our own comfort. But we don't have to do all of it alone. Seeking out support from others may seem like a no-brainer, but some people find it hard to take that step toward others when we are hurting. It might help to remember that most people actually enjoy being needed, enjoy offering solace and being leaned on at times. Giving them the opportunity to help you may also be giving a gift to them. Well, self-comfort is only half of what Nancy asked for in this auction sermon. We may know what helps us through challenges and tragedies, whether it be the right thought to think that we finally land on, or seeking friends and other people to help us through, or remembering the giftedness of life itself. But how do we reach out and help others? Here is another poem by Ellen Bass. It's titled French Chocolates. If you have your health, you have everything, is something that's said to cheer you up. When you come home early and find your lover arched over a stranger in a scarlet thong. Or it could be you lose your job at Happy Nails because you can't stop smudging the stars on those 10 teeny American flags. I don't begrudge you your extravagant vitality. May it blossom like a cherry tree. May the petals of your cardiovascular excellence and the accordion polka of your lungs sweeten the mornings of your loneliness. But for the ill, for you with nerves that fire like a rusted out burner on an old barbecue, with bones brittle as spun sugar, with a migraine hammering like a blacksmith in the flaming forge of your skull, may you be spared from friends who say, God doesn't give you any more than you can handle. And ask what gifts being sick has brought you. May they just keep their mouths shut. And give you French chocolates and daffodils and maybe a small original Matisse. Say, open window, collier, so you can look out at the boats floating on the dappled pink water. Embedded in this poem is a great lesson on how not to give comfort to someone in need. Don't shower the person with what seem to be soothing words, like if you have your health, you have everything, when someone's life has fallen apart, or asserting, God doesn't give you more than you can handle, when you are physically sick or in despair. Many people spill those platitudes from their mouths, trying to comfort. But needless to say, this is not a helpful approach. When I was a chaplain intern in a hospital setting during my seminary training, I visited a heart patient who was in pain and was expressing fear about her impending surgery. We were talking quietly when a hospital volunteer, what we called a candy striper in those red and white stripes, burst into the room with a big lipstick smile. The volunteer asked, "So how are we doing today?" The patient responded softly, "Not very well." But the candy striper appeared not to hear. She breezed across the room, saying, almost in one breath, "I'm glad you're fine. It's such a nice day. Don't you think we should let the sunshine in? You'll feel better." She threw open the curtains and continued, "There, that's better. Let me know if I can get you anything. You have a good day. Bye now." And out she went. The volunteer clearly meant well, but this effusive cheerfulness was not, clearly not, what the patient wanted or needed at that moment. This incident stayed with me, particularly because at that hospital, we chaplain interns were learning in our group sessions the techniques of active listening, being attentive to the person's words and the unspoken feelings beneath the words. In the course of this training, we also learned about some of the less helpful kinds of communication, like giving advice or offering solutions, analyzing, questioning, distracting, persuading, or judging. The well-meaning candy striper seemed to run through several of these in the space of 20 seconds. What she didn't do is really listen. As the volunteer breezed out, the patient winced, took the hand that I offered her, and just said, "It hurts." Another thing I remember from those long ago days when I was a chaplain intern was the story of a family that was beset with the tragic loss of a child in an accident. The family later reported to our chaplain supervisor that they were much comforted by a local priest who visited them in the emergency room of the hospital as they learned the sad news of their loss. Eager to learn, we interns wondered what the priest could possibly have said that was so healing. Fortunately, one of the interns was there with the priest and told us that the priest said simply, "These things happen." When the family asked that inevitable, agonized question, "Why?" The priest didn't say anything like, "God has a plan we don't understand," or "Your child is with God now," or "You will learn from this suffering," or other platitudes. Just, "These things happen." He said nothing terribly profound, but the priest was there with the family and stayed with them throughout their ordeal. And we all learned the lesson. It wasn't any magic words. It was his warm and caring presence that brought comfort. And it's a lesson I never forgot. Just be there with those in need. Just listen, hug, offer a hand, look into their eyes, connect, even feel their pain and cry with them. Don't reassure them that everything will be okay, because it won't. It's not certain words or techniques or theological assertions that will bring the comfort. It is our caring presence. Ram Dass and Paul Gorman, in their book, How Can I Help?, speak of natural compassion, the human impulse to help others. They say that human caring is a reflex that people instinctively act to help others in need. It's built into us. And we've all heard stories of people in emergencies and crises risking their lives to get someone out of a burning building, pulling someone out of a wreck, performing CPR on an unconscious person. I have noticed that when people who act on this caring impulse are called heroes by the media, they often reject this honor, saying that they just did what they had to do, what anyone would do without thinking. Caring, say Gorman and Ram Dass, is the instinctive response of an open heart. And they add that acts of caring bind us together as a community. In service, they say, we taste unity. There are some other things we can do to offer comfort as people begin to heal from trauma, from grief, from loss, from despair. After the initial shock, and when they are ready, you can take them to a favorite place, go to a movie with them, call on them, bring in a meal, bring French chocolates, stay in contact. That's something our pastoral care committee does here in this congregation for people in need. All of it really just comes down to your presence, to your caring, and your attentive listening without judgment, without advice. It is both simple and profound. Here's a story from the Jewish Talmud. Rabbi Hiabar Abba fell ill, and Rabbi Yochanan went in to visit him. He said to him, "Are your sufferings welcome to you?" He replied, "Neither they nor their reward." He said to him, "Give me your hand." He gave him his hand, and he supported him. Rabbi Yochanan once fell ill, and Rabbi Chanina went in to visit him. He said to him, "Are your sufferings welcome to you?" He replied, "Neither they nor their reward." He said to him, "Give me your hand." He gave him his hand, and he supported him. Why could not Rabbi Yochanan support himself? The Talmud replies, "The prisoner cannot free himself from jail." Sometimes, when none of our techniques for comforting ourselves are working, we need support from others. And sometimes, when we see another's pain, we feel that inner call to offer what comfort we can. As our opening reading put it, we need one another. In that human encounter of one person comforting another, something amazing often happens. This is illustrated by this short quote from Ram Dass and Gorman, from their book, How Can I Help? And I close with their words. At a certain point, helper and helped simply begin to dissolve. What is real is the helping, the process in which we are all blessed according to our needs and our place at the moment. How much we can get back in giving, how much we offer in the way we receive. But even giving and receiving now seem artificial. Where does one begin, the other end?